Welcome to The Lobbying Show, the show about the people in government relations, how they got into it, and what their jobs entail, what works and what doesn't. I am the host, Jim O'Brien.
Well, everyone, we're a couple weeks into the show and the feedback has been great. Thanks to everyone who has listened in so far. Amazingly, you have helped us crack the top 20 podcasts in our category, government and organizations. Incredible. So we're still working out the kinks, and we appreciate all the feedback that you have given us and keep giving us more. If you have any suggestions for improving the show or have an idea for a great guest, shoot us an email at hello@thelobbyingshow.com. Again, that's hello@thelobbyingshow.com or tweet us at The Lobbying Show. We would love to hear from you. Finally, and most importantly, if you like what you're hearing, and even if you don't, please subscribe to our podcast and give us a rating. It helps other podcast listeners find our show. Now that we've got the business out of the way, let's get to today's episode. Eric Schuler is the Director of Government and Community Affairs at Oasis Financial and serves as President of the Alliance of Responsible Consumer Legal Funding. He is also a veteran with 22 years of service in the U.S. Army and National Guard. Like many government affairs professionals, Eric got into the industry in a roundabout kind of way, beginning with the Lieutenant Governor's office in Illinois. I enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you will too. So Eric, since you have decades of service in military intelligence and counterintelligence, you probably already know what I'm gonna ask you.
Well, I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
So why don't you start off by telling us about your military service?
Served 23 years in the military, started out in aviation. I was a crew chief on a Huey, and then from there transferred into a unit that we did intelligence, counterintelligence operations. Served most of my time in the European theater, a little bit of time in the Middle East. Did a lot of work with the liaison for the German Territorial Army and NATO in those kind of aspects. Worked quite a bit looking at that time, the Soviet Union and their tactics. And it's interesting, it's all coming back again in the new politics. And then retired out of the military in 01.
Okay. And you spent how many years in the military?
Almost 23 years.
Wow. Well, that's great. Thank you for your service.
Appreciate it.
So for all of our guests, we have Eric Schuler here this morning. I think now we can back up a bit and talk about prior to you being in the military. Where did you grow up? Where are you from?
From Chicago area, pretty much. I mean, originally when I was a young, until about 8 years old, lived in Minnesota. And then my mom got remarried and we moved to the Chicago area, to the western suburbs, and lived in the western suburbs ever since then. So it's a great area. Love Chicago. Great place in the summertime. Sometimes not so good in the winter, but when you get the good, you got to get the bad sometimes too.
Right. What high school did you go to?
Lyons Township High School. My class was one of the biggest classes ever that graduated out of LT. 2,000 kids in my high school graduating class.
Wow. And what were your interests back then in high school and then in college? Any sports or things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I played basketball.
For your high school team?
Well, it was funny. Not so much on the team, but it was first day of basketball. I was going on the team for the basketball for the senior year. Got on the team and first day off, first full day of practice, the ball hits me right in my finger, my left hand, and breaks my finger. The only broken bone I've had in my entire life. And so I got replaced on the team because I couldn't play with a broken finger. And the person that replaced me on the team was Jeff Hornacek, who went on to play for the Utah Jazz, is now a NBA coach. And I run into him a couple of times afterwards. And I've said, I kind of shook my finger at him and says, see this finger right here? It's the only reason you've got a career in the NBA.
You launched his career.
I launched his career.
Well, if you can make a basketball team of a school of 5,000 plus students, you must be a pretty good hoop player.
Well, I was. Not so much anymore, but it wasn't too bad.
Yeah. Where'd you go to college?
University of Illinois, Chicago.
Okay. What happened? What'd you do after college? Right into the military?
Well, I was actually in the military when I was going through college as well. Did that stint pretty much the whole time. I did some time active duties and some time with the National Guard. And then, like I said, retired in 01.
Okay. And so what was your first political or government relations job?
Well, it was kind of interesting. I didn't have a real forte into politics. I always was political. But in 2002, when Blagojevich and Quinn got elected governor, lieutenant governor, then Lieutenant Governor Quinn was looking to do something military orientated, and he was looking around for someone to bring onto his staff to do that. And apparently he was asking around, and my name came up several times. And so his campaign person called me up and said, hey, would you like to meet the new lieutenant governor, come down to the inauguration and see where things go? And I'm like, well, I've never been to an inauguration before. Why not? Met him, and then ended up starting work for him about a month and a half later, initially starting into doing military veterans issues with him. We actually became a national leader in dealing with military veterans issues because this was the height of Iraq, Afghanistan. Unfortunately, one of my duties was to work with, I should say fortunate and unfortunate, was to work with the families of the fallen service members during the time frame. Attended 157 funerals of fallen service members. And it was a very important part of my job, being a, you know, retired out of the military and seeing that these families were taken care of. Passed quite a bit of legislation in Illinois, worked on a national scale with other lieutenant governor's offices, in which we got 35 states to pass a similar type of legislation we had in Illinois, Military Family Relief Act, which helps out the members of the National Guard who were called up to active duty with some financial assistance and with that. And then from there, I branched down to other areas and policies within the structure of the state. And then from there, I went and ran a...
So Eric, so just backing up for a second. So going to 157 funerals over what, that's like a 2-year period or something?
About 5 years.
5 years. So all the families from the state of Illinois who lost a loved one in Iraq or Afghanistan, and I mean, that must be just a life-changing experience, going to that many funerals and that many, dealing with that many families. That's incredible.
It was, and you know, I became friends with some of them. In fact, to this day, even though it's been over 10 years, I still keep in touch with several of the families. I've become friends with them. And, you know, you become a family. And unfortunately, it's sometimes you're thrust into a family situation you didn't want to be thrust into, but you do. And you adapt, you overcome, and you make the best of a bad situation, for lack of a better term, and you help. And what I thought was extremely encouraging and inspirational were a lot of these families wanted to give back. A lot of them started up their own charities. The Frank family was one that comes to mind. Their son, they at that time lived in New Jersey, and they literally saw the Twin Towers coming down from their front yard from New Jersey. And they moved to Illinois, and he joined the Marine Corps, and unfortunately he was killed. But his family started a charity that gave back to wounded service members. They raised money to give walking devices, canes or walkers, to service members who were injured and couldn't do it. They donated money to Heinz. I mean, I can't tell you how many counts of thousands of dollars that they put together. That they started a foundation called Harvard Marine and gave back. There's other families that did the same thing, that started up foundations and charities to give back in service of their families. We had another family that started a fishing campaign for young kids, members of the service. Their son was an avid fisherman, and he loved to go fishing with his grandfather every year. So what they did is they formed a charity that once a year, they get a bunch of military kids, and they take them out for a day of fishing in honor of their son who was killed. And so it's quite inspiring.
And would you have, what would be your role at these funerals?
Really to be with the families and ensure, because, you know, at that time, there was a lot of red tape that was happening. I don't think the military was expecting the amount of casualties that happened. And so I could, knowing both sides of the fence, so to speak, knowing the military end of it and also the civilian government end of it, I was able to kind of bridge that in between the two. So if there were any issues with the families, such as placement of medals or, you know, ensuring that proper honors were done, things like that. You know, sometimes in situations like this that come through, people just tune out and they don't hear everything. And sometimes people talk in military speak and they don't understand, if you haven't been exposed to that, what that is. So I was kind of able to translate between military speak and civilian. And so the families knew exactly what was happening, what was going to take place, how it was going to take place, and then be there for them after the fact. We've got some statutes passed in Illinois that allowed them to get some extra insurance programs, some extra benefits. I was also able to, for 8 service members, grant them citizenship. Unfortunately, 4 of those 8 was posthumously. You know, it was just basically being there for them to make sure that they had the resources that they needed to do to kind of go on.
So you had 8 people from the state of Illinois who passed away who were not even citizens at that point?
No, we had citizenship for 8. 4 of them were posthumous. So when they were killed, of those 4, they were not citizens, and we got citizenship granted for them posthumously, which helped their family. In a couple instances, they were married, so as a result, their spouse automatically became citizen as well. And it was interesting, of the 8 individuals overall, only 4 were Hispanic. The other ones were Polish and English, the other 2 each. So, you know, a lot of times people think, oh, illegal aliens and that kind of stuff, thinking from a certain part of the world. You know, these were men and women that were willing to put their life on the line for a new country. And I think that's the least we could do, is to grant them citizenship.
I think a lot of people will be surprised to learn that you don't have to be a citizen to actually serve.
Right. You just have to be a resident of the United States. It's helpful if you have special skills such as translations, and that does help. If you're going into a part of the world in which you need some translations abilities, it's great to have a native speaking person.
Right. And so you worked for Lieutenant Governor Quinn for 5 years?
About 7 years.
7 years. Okay. And then when you left working for him, what did you do?
From there, I went to work for Operation Homefront, which is a national charity for service members, and I ran the Illinois operations for them. And so I'm still dealing with military veterans issues, raising money, helping with charitable situations from them. A lot of times, you know, you get some families, especially National Guard and reservists, who get called up making good money, and all of a sudden their pay gets cut in half. And sometimes families have a hard time making ends meet. We kind of work with them to help them over some financial burdens. Sometimes, again, cutting through the red tape of the bureaucracy, still having my good contacts with the state and Veterans Affairs, and be able to help with that.
And how did you end up working for OASIS and the Alliance for Responsible Consumer Legal Funding, known as ARC?
It's kind of interesting. The CEO at the time of OASIS was looking to make some charitable donations, and he called up Operation Homefront one day and was talking and said he was looking to make a sizable donation. And so he asked me to come into the office, and we talked. And as he was talking, he says, well, I'm looking to bring somebody on board to do government affairs for me. Would you be interested? And the rest is history.
And when was that?
That was 2008.
Okay. 2008. And why don't you tell our listeners about what OASIS and ARC, what they do?
Yeah, so from OASIS, I also take on responsibility of running our trade association, as you stated, Alliance Responsible Consumer Legal Funding. And what our companies do is provide financial assistance to consumers that typically have a pending legal claim, like a car accident. What we do is provide them a little bit of funds up front, and they collect on the back end plus a fee. But if their case doesn't resolve, or if there are insufficient funds or the proceeds of the legal claim to pay the companies back, they owe nothing. And so they pay the companies back after their case settles and if there's sufficient funds out of the proceeds of the legal claim to pay us back. And if there aren't any, then they don't. It's a way of kind of bridging some financial assistance while their case is pending. Typically our average consumer, someone who's paying their bills, working paycheck to paycheck. You know, unfortunately, there's been a lot of statistics out there that I think 67% of American households have less than $1,000 in savings for emergency situations. And so kind of our average person is in that category who's paying their bills, making a good living, but all of a sudden they get in a car accident, no fault of their own, driving home from work one day and someone blows a red light or sideswipes them or whatever it is. And as a result of their injuries, maybe they miss a couple of paychecks. And now they're back at work, but they've fallen behind their mortgage, rent, car payments, things like that. So we take a look at the cases and say, okay, your case should settle for X, give them some money up front, and kind of help them bridge that gap while their case is pending. So this way they can get a fair and equitable offer.
And then you take a piece of the settlement at the end.
It's a fee-based structure. So it's all laid out right up front. Yeah. So it's not a, we're very clear that we do not take a portion. Right. And the other thing too, we're very clear on is that the money that we provide the consumers does not go to further the litigation. In other words, they can't use the money to pay for expert witnesses, to pay for legal fees, things like that. The money is only to be used for immediate household needs. In other words, to make sure they've got a roof over their head, food on the table, and they can turn the lights on.
And how many clients or cases will, say, Oasis deal with in a given year?
That's proprietary information, but we help thousands of people every year. Our average funding that we help consumers is about $2,000. So we're not giving people tens of thousands of dollars. It's just enough to get them over that little bit of a hump. That's all you need sometimes. It's just that little bit of bump just to make sure you can go through.
And how many employees does Oasis have?
Right now, we have about 250 employees.
Wow, big company. And how many member companies make up ARC?
We don't release our membership, but I can say that from an industry standpoint, we service probably about 60% of the industry.
Okay. And when you're going into a state and dealing with legislation, is there a typical scenario that you're dealing with and trying to proactively pass something or trying to prevent something? Or is there a typical situation that you're encountering?
Yeah, a lot of the times it is reactive situations in which we'll deal with a piece of legislation that is adverse to our industry. Our typical adversary, for lack of a better term, is the property casualty insurance companies, in which they don't have a big fondness for our industry because we allow consumers to kind of hang on and not be forced to take the first offer that comes along. So they will introduce legislation that limits our practice into how we can operate in the state, and whether it's restricting the amount of funds we can give a consumer or potential profits we can make, things like that. There actually was legislation about 5 or 6 years ago to try and literally ban our industry from existence. But legislatures kind of saw through that wasn't a viable solution because we are offering a legitimate service to consumers. Fortunately, we don't have the vast depth of lobbying resources that our, quote, opponents do on the other side. So we kind of sometimes have to go and play catch up when something happens in a state and to kind of educate legislators very quickly on the issues, sometimes clarifying issues that may have been misconstrued as to what it is that we do not do.
And what states have you been spending most of your time in the past, say, couple of years?
It's been a kind of a wide variety, a lot in the Midwest, East Coast. We've had some stuff in Nevada and Arizona, quite a bit in the Midwest and in the South is where we've had it.
And do you oversee all 50 states?
Yes.
And how many states do you have lobbyists on the ground?
Well, we have resources in right now I can tap into 30 at least, but in the other states I don't have somebody with different organizations that I belong to and are affiliated with. I can, put a call and say, hey, I need somebody in this state. Who do you recommend? And get somebody quickly. This past year, we had about 9 states we had active situations in. It's been as high as a couple of years ago where I had 22 bills in 16 states going on at one time.
Boy, that's a lot to cover. And when you're looking for the lobbyists, state lobbyists that may be listening, when you're looking for a recommendation, say you're going into a state, you know, like Kentucky or whatever it may be, whom do you typically call, or what type? I'm not looking for a specific name, but what type of person will you look to call to get a recommendation?
Well, typically what I look for is someone who's, you know, maybe has some experience with financial services, because that's what we are. So they're familiar with the possibly the type of product that we offer to consumers. One thing that I do have a difficulty sometimes in finding some people is the fact of I can't use anybody that the insurance companies have used in the past. And unfortunately for me, they have a vast tentacle of a lot of lobbyists that they use. So that kind of cuts down in the number of lobbyists that I can tap into. But we've been very successful in getting good lobbyists. I've got some really fantastic lobbying teams that I deal with. One thing I was just talking about this to somebody the other day that surprised the number of family lobbying teams that I do have. Either it's a husband and wife or father and children. Or in fact, in one case, it's husband, wife, daughter team. And they've been very successful. In fact, sometimes even more successful than very large lobbying firms. And that what I find is they kind of bring a unique spin to the situation in which they know the legislators personally and they kind of have that family resource type of thing. And you kind of get into to know the lobbyists and the legislators intimately. And it helps in when you're presenting your point of view to them.
Do you attend any of the legislative conferences during the summer?
Yeah, I attend quite a few of them. Just came back from CSG Midwest, heading out to Council of Western Attorney General. So I meet with the AGs as well. Then from there, I'm going to NCSL, and then from NCSL to CSG East, and then ALEC, and then also CSG West, and then the national CSG conferences as well.
Boy, you hit them all.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the last thing I would ask you, Eric, this has been great, thank you, is how did you get involved with the Impact Fund and the NFL?
That is kind of a leftover from my days with the state. Got to know through a charitable thing some of the 85 Bears, and then from there got to work with the originally Dicka's charity was Gridiron Greats. They kind of morphed into After the Impact. And so it kind of helps me keep in touch and do some of the stuff I was doing with before. There's a lot of similarities between the NFL concussion issues and traumatic brain injury issues that our members in uniform have come across. It's the same type of an impact, you know, whether you're heading down the football field and someone hits you and you rattle your head, or an IED goes off and you're rattling your head in your helmet. It's the same type of concussive injury. And there's a lot of similarities going through. So what the organization tries to do is work with both veterans and with NFL players to kind of help them with the situation. People don't realize that some of the former NFL players didn't make the millions of dollars they make today. And they are, a lot of them are suffering physically from playing for a number of years and not getting proper medical care on the football field and after the football field. And as a result, are financially strapped. And same thing with our veterans, all from a lot of it's well from traumatic brain injuries. So we try to bridge that gap in between the two.
Well, Eric, this has been great. We appreciate taking the time to do this. So thank you.
I appreciate it.
That's it for the show this week. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe to our podcast and give us a rating. It will help other podcast listeners find our show. Have a great week and see you next week.